From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made last month when Congresswoman Judy Chu of California introduced a new bill that would increase mental health awareness among the Asian American community. Mental illness is rarely discussed in that community. The stigma attached to the topic leads many people to suffer in silence, and that's true for people of all backgrounds and ethnicities. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 60% of adults and 50% of youth with mental illness did not receive treatment in the last year. In 1999, the U.S. Surgeon General labeled stigma as perhaps the biggest barrier to mental health care in this country. So what can we do to address this stigma and help close the gap in care? Compeer Rochester is taking the issue head-on with its volunteer mentoring program. This hour, we're going to talk to people who have participated in that program about the benefits of friendship and a mentoring relationship and how it's helping to reduce the stigma of mental illness. And we will talk about how you can volunteer if you like. You may have wondered how much time. What does that entail? What are the relationships like? What are the sort of the barriers to becoming a volunteer? All of those things and more. And let me welcome Dana Frame, who is the executive director of Compeer Rochester. Dana, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
Dr. Stacy Killings is a crisis therapist at Strong Memorial Hospital. She's a school psychologist at Gates Chilai High School, and she's on the Compeer Rochester board. Stacy, welcome to you.
Thank you, Evan.
We have an adult match. It's Jim Sedita. Jim, welcome to you.
Thanks, Evan.
And Steve Smock, welcome to you, Steve.
Thank you.
And Josh Lowe is here as well, who has come into contact, and we'll be talking about Josh's story with Compeer Rochester. Josh, welcome to you.
Thanks, Evan.
Let me just start with Dana Frame, who's executive director of Compeer Rochester. Real quick, before we dive into what these matching programs are and volunteering, for those who say Compeer sounds like my computer company, do you come? Do you do IT work at home? What is Compeer?
Well, it's not computers.
It's not computers.
Believe me, we're social workers over there, and we're very low tech.
Yes.
No, but what Compeer is actually a word in the dictionary, and it means companion peer, and that's what we're all about, putting people together to help each other move forward.
Serving how many?
We serve approximately 500 people a year.
And the goal is to increase that.
Oh, the goal is very much to increase that. We have a list of folks that don't have a volunteer yet that probably is pretty much close to 150 people at all times.
So if you had 150 new volunteer mentors tomorrow, you could serve maybe 150 new people.
Well, I hope so. Yes, we could.
Okay. And so we'll talk about that coming up here. Dr. Killings, from your perspective, I know stigma comes up a lot. And I think hearing the personal stories at the table this hour are going to help us understand the challenges, but also the benefits of really addressing this with mentorship. For you, what are the benefits of a mentoring program like this?
Well, it provides one-on-one personal support. It provides someone to be that friend, that confidant, and it can also provide an individual or individuals to get that individual out into the community and engaging in activities within the community, things that can help him or her be successful and stay healthy.
I saw when we were reading the introduction on the U.S. Surgeon General, I mean, that's 18 years ago now, that they were warning that stigma is the biggest barrier to entry, and I'm not sure we've changed on that.
No, I don't think we have. According to the National Institute of Mental Illness, there are approximately 450 million adults in the United States of America who suffer from mental illness, and the stigma is huge. Oftentimes, people think that persons with mental illness are apathetic and or lazy, and that truly is not the case. Persons suffering from mental illness, it's like a disease, and they need help with that illness and support.
So step one to destigmatizing.
Absolutely. Destigmatizing, understanding mental illness. It is not something that is contagious. Understanding that mental illness can be treated and understanding that individuals with mental illness are people, and they need everything supports from the community and within the community just like you or I.
I want to talk to Jim and Steve about, you know, what it means to be an adult match. And Dana, why don't you first when I ask Dana to sort of introduce the concept here. So before we talk to Jim and Steve, go ahead.
About what we do with Compeer. Well, we work with the mental health community, and they send us referrals with people that are at a point in their recovery where they need some help getting out into the community. Just as Stacy said, that's so important. What we impact is the isolation that people feel when they have mental illness, with because of the barriers to getting help, getting jobs, getting apartments, all of that good stuff that you need to be a good citizen. So we put people together. Our volunteers come to us from all walks of life, all ages, all communities, many of whom have either had some mental health problems in their lifetime, or they've had a family member, or they've known somebody, and they just want to give back because they know how important it is.
All right, so let's talk to Jim and Steve then. And Steve, I'll start with you. Before the program began, you were beginning to tell me a little bit about your background and your story, and go ahead, why don't you share?
Yes. I have a long history. I was a troubled youth, a troubled child, born into trouble, an abusive household. My first psychiatrist was at 8 years old in Canandaigua. I grew up in Canandaigua. That's where it all started for me in childhood. And in teenage years, I was a troubled youth. I got sent away. I was a teenage criminal. I got into drugs and alcohol, rock and roll, you know, just sex and drugs and just rebellion and rage. I had so much rage and anger.
Can I ask you, but as you're kind of flying through your story here, and but when you say rage, did you feel angry at everything? Was it directed in any certain way?
It was at my dad but anyways, I want to talk about the stigma.
Sure.
I looked it up in the dictionary before, and in solutions. I want to talk about solutions because I'm 60 years old, and I've had a long history of mental illness, severe, homeless all over the country, jails, institutions, facilities, just the horror, the hellish, tormented, tortured life that I just want to educate and speak to all the listening audience. That we're sons and daughters, and we have, just like the doctor was saying, that we're human beings too, and we have emotions and we have feelings, and we're the solution for me, the stigma means, I looked it up in the dictionary, it means disgrace and discredit. And going, you know, and without that help, I started getting help through Compere, my match, Jim, and that was the culmination 9 years ago. We've been together for 9 years. And then with the Veteran Outreach Center, with the art therapy and the combination, then being clean and sober for over 4+ years, and the combination of the Compere match and our long, loving relationship. But it's about love and kindness and hope for a mentally and emotionally well life. And coming to that through a lot of hard work on my part to get the demons out of me. And the spiritual aspect, the solution for me, the mental wellness and the emotional wellness and the physical wellness, and it's the fundamental in the spiritual wellness, the spiritual significance with our Creator for me, and the spiritual aspect, getting right with God, who God sees me, my thoughts and stuff. And so the solution, I'm restored back to my youthful exuberance and my outgoing extroverted sense of humor. I love life. I have a lot of loving outside the box, cutting edge, Compere included, Veteran Outreach Center, Battle Buddies with the VOC, Compere Corps. Just been a wonderful experience for me. I love life, and I love being here in this opportunity.
Congratulations on your sobriety.
Thank you.
And I know it's a lot of work. When did you said you got in touch with Compere for the first time? Was it
about 9 years ago.
About 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And when did you know you were ready for that?
Well, I was still active drinking and drugging and crazy out of my mind, suffering. It was a negative coping method, and Jim put up with me. He's the saint, you know. He's above and beyond the call of duty as far, you know. I call it the Congressional Medal of Honor for volunteers for people who suffer mental and emotional illness. And he put up with me through the thick. You see me at my worst, was suicidal. And, you know, I had suicide, went through it 4 times. And 2013, and then the art therapy and Compere, the combination, the church, pastors and Christian brothers and sisters, and just the loving support from my blood family, and just being there. And did that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. obviously, you were going through a lot, and you said that Jim had the patience of a saint. Let me ask Jim, and getting right close to that mic for me, Jim.
Yeah.
So what led you to work with Compere in the first place?
I had a Compere one time back in the day, 20 years ago, and he suggested at the time that, you know, why don't you do the same as I do, you know? I said, well, why not? So I volunteered, and subsequently continued some years later. I believe maybe 10 years after I had a compeer, and springboarded from that.
What was the benefit to your life of having a compeer?
He listened. He just listened to what I had to say. You know, that was the biggest benefit for me, just someone to talk with about what was bothering me at the time, or, you know, whatever I had on my mind. And he was a volunteer, you know. He wasn't paid for it. You know, he did it because he wanted to. He felt, you know, a need to give back to the community, and he did.
So you became a volunteer. You meet Steve. What do you remember about meeting Steve? Why are you laughing, Steve?
It's funny.
No, we met. I said, boy, this guy's gonna be a this guy's a tiger. He's gonna be somebody to deal with, you know, because he's got a lot.
Steve's got a big smile at that.
He's got a lot on his mind, and he's got a lot to say. And you know, Steve's a veteran of the U.S. Navy, stateside. He told me, and initially. I found Steve very, very interesting, compelling even to listen to what he had to say, because he had a lot to say. You know, I know he's been diagnosed, so have I. I'm a consumer myself. So when he started telling me his story, I said, boy, this is going to be a interesting stay. You know,
and so that was your first encounter, and for you then, how many times do you guys get together?
Once a week for 9 years.
For 9 years?
Yeah, once every week. We rendezvous at his place at Southview Towers, and you know, we just
spend about an hour or so.
Sometimes more. Mm-hmm. You know, depends, you know, on the situation, and if he needs. I've taken him to visit his brother in Canandaigua. You know. A few, I don't know how many times, but over the years. And we see, the thing is, the objective of being a compeer, and Steve is my friend, is to allow or trying to get the guys out into the community to socialize, get them out of the apartment so they can have a little fun. Like, I've taken friends fishing, we go bowling, we, you know. Multitude of things, you know, movies, you know, whatever they like to do. I always say to them, it's your oyster, you know.
Yeah.
You gotta live it. So, you know, I'm just here to help you.
And
you know?
From that initial meeting where you knew that Steve was a character, was there a moment where it hit you that things were, that he was either opening up more or at least, you know, that you saw progress?
Well, yeah. I've seen progress.
Yeah.
In the Lance.
Well, clearly. I mean, he's doing so well, and
yeah.
I
mean,
really appreciate it.
I mean, initially, I said it's going to be interesting because I had done similar work at the Mental Health Association before I came to compeer. So at that point, I was a peer coach, and similarly, I had the same title at compeer, but. Initially, Steve he had a lot of issues, okay? And subsequently, in the last 4 to 5 years, he's come full circle. He's made a full circle. I mean, it's unbelievable.
What's the biggest difference you see?
The biggest difference? Well, for one, he doesn't imbibe or, you mm-hmm. know, do drugs or what he used to do. He was arrested at one point when I knew him, before he got, so to say, better and
sober. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, he did. I remember we were sitting on the international bridge across the river, you know, in downtown Rochester, and I was talking about a suicide. I really did. I mean, he listened, and he said, you know, it worked.
Well,
so
Steve, for you, what do you remember about meeting Jim? And did you want that? Did you want to open up to somebody?
Well, Evan, it was a long, it's, you know, a long journey, very painful journey, step by step. I was hard-headed, pig-headed, stubborn, and you know, I just knew I was so desperate for help to emotionally and mentally have a balance. And the match Compure provided that initial stage, and no, I wasn't there. No, I was still resistant. I just was searching for that inner peace, and Compure provided that bridge, that first step to a mental and emotional wellness, like I was sharing earlier, and then the Veteran Outreach Center right across the street on Comfort and South, where I live. And I've been part of that art therapy program. So in the spiritual aspect, and I just, you know, give all thanks to God, because I believe God put Compure in my life, and the professionals, the loving professionals in my life, who care about my life and welfare, and I'm doing great. And it's just a wonderful experience to be on the show and talking to the listening audience.
Well, I know it's a real inspiration for a lot of people. And Steve, did you grow to pretty quickly? Did you look forward to spending time with him, or did you think, well, I have to do this, or I signed up for this, or, you know, how was that?
Well, let me tell you the hardcore reality.
Yeah.
In 2012, I was still drinking and drugging, and I had 3 mental health arrests, suicide by cop. And I just want to share that little story about where the homeless mentally ill and the criminalization of mentally ill, and you know, and ordinances, quality of life ordinances, to prevent, you know, arresting homeless people for being homeless, and got, you know, and the hellish. And I just saying, and then I got sober and clean, and it was just a long, painful, excruciating. It took courage for me to open up and be vulnerable and share my pain and suffering with caring professionals in my life, and professional help, psychiatrists, therapists, counselors, social workers, doctors, and Compure. So it's a culmination, and pastors seeking counsel for that peace that I've got now today.
And, you know, Jim talked about those moments where, you know, you were at the darkest moments of your life. You know, what do you remember about your relationship with him that allowed you to at least listen, to open up a little bit to him?
Well, he was a bridge. He was always there for me. He's always encouraging. He was always supportive. He was always positive, always trying to give me insights onto alternative choices in my thought process and my decision making. So it's been a long, hard ride. And you know, it took a lot of work, and, you know, I just live one day at a time, one breath at a time, and just being grateful and thankful that I'm alive and breathing and be able to be on this broadcast.
Well, what do you want to do now?
Well, I'm a multidimensional artist. I've had 3 successful art shows, and the latest one at...
The guy named Smock is an artist?
Yeah.
I love that.
Matter of fact, that's funny, because there's another Steve Smock in Rochester who's also an artist. I never met him, though.
Is that right? It was faded. But go ahead. Don't let me interrupt you.
But so anyways, the solution, you know, I agree with the panel here. It's all about solution. There is hope for there. Anybody listening, any mother or father listening right now has a son or a daughter who's suffering right now emotionally or mentally and disturbed. I'd encourage them to seek professional help, and as the responsibility of the mother. I'm not a parent. I never had kids, never married because of my illness. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like a blessing now, but I encourage mothers or fathers or grandparents who have children, or, you know, and it is most mental illness comes from abuse and trauma in childhood, and it's unresolved, and some people carry it through their whole life, and sad to say, 22 veterans a day die, they kill themselves, suicide, and that's not counting the civilian population, the young teenagers and young, and so it's a horrible disease, it's a horrible reality, it's a horrible life untreated, and there's hope out there, and there's wellness, and there's love out there, and there's goodness out there, and I just want to encourage that for the listening audience.
Well, Dr. Killing, many times you have a big smile on your face as he tells his story, and I know that, you know, you've worked with so many people in your career who might not always have that perspective he has now. What was it like for you listening to that story?
Well, you know, it's a blessing to be in Steve's presence because he truly has a testimony to share with people. And I think it's important to note that the, you know, mental illness, you know, we're talking about Compeer, but I think it's important that individuals understand there is also the therapeutic medical piece. In addition to Compeer, it's important for a person suffering or dealing with any with someone who is mentally ill that they get the appropriate and correct treatment of that mental illness, whether it be medication, you know, psychotropic medications, therapy. Actually, those two things coupled together are the best treatment for mental illness, the counseling component as well as the medical component. And often as a therapist, we encourage our clients or individuals who are suffering from mental illness to go out and get involved in the community. And that is so much easier said than done. And that is where we can partner with Compeer, because telling someone who's been isolated and withdrawn and dealing with anxiety or depression or any other type of mood disorder, telling someone to just go on out and make a friend or, you know, go to the bowling alley or go watch a movie, that is very, very difficult. And Compeer is able to step in there and provide those mentors and create those friendships and help that individual who is oftentimes isolating him or herself to say, hey, you know what? I bought us two movie tickets. Let's go. It's much easier when you have someone knock on your door and say, hey, come on, let's go. And so that's the way therapists and Compeer, that's how we can partner together to help our individuals within the community.
And Dana, you know, it's Dr. Killings is right. Compeer can do that, but you could do a little bit more of that if you had more volunteers.
So yes,
you heard Jim telling his story, but let's just back it up and start from scratch here. Any listener who wants to volunteer for Compeer, what does that entail? What is the process like? Take me through that.
The process is very supportive and well thought out. We have an evidence-based model, which doesn't mean, means a lot to us, but to most people it doesn't. But
I think it does. I think that's great.
Yeah. And it involves the partnership with the mental health piece. Absolutely. In fact, we know that if somebody is in treatment and is getting the correct services, one of the best reasons that they will recover is that they have a supportive relationship in their life, and that's definitely where we come in. So a volunteer is well prepared. We do have to do screening on our volunteers, obviously, to make sure that, you know, they're doing it for the right motivation, and the training we go through, which is a lot of general mental health, but really we don't talk about it until we're close to matching them with somebody, and then we tell about, you know, the specific things that this person would need in their relationship. And there's training after the match, as well as we do activities, group activities, to help them get going, that kind of thing. So it's really very supportive. They can call us at any time. They can have they can call the mental health professional as well, and if they're worried about some things. So.
And once you get into a groove and once you get going, it's roughly how much a month?
We ask
much
for
time.
4 hours a month.
4 hours a month.
And as you say, in the beginning, you should do it more often, mm-hmm, and less time, just to get you know, more comfortable with each other and all of that. Because it's weird when you meet somebody for the first time. It's a little awkward.
Sure.
Right?
But roughly 4 hours a month is what we're talking about. About an hour a week.
Yep. Of course, some people, once you get going, we ask for a year's commitment. Mm-hmm. I do want to say that. That's part of the evidence-based. It does need to last a year. But I've had very few volunteers call me on their year anniversary and say, I'm done, because they're not. They have a new friend.
Yeah, Jim and Steve are working on 9 years there. So.
Right.
And Jim, why don't you grab that microphone, because I saw you reacting to some of what Dana said there. So for you, how do you consider the time commitment for this?
Oh, it's a joy. It's a joy for me because, you know, I an hour a week, I do more than that. I mean, it's like riding a bicycle. You know, I just keep.
And you described Steve as a friend.
Yeah, he's a bona fide friend. Yeah, I've known him longer than, you know, I've got five brothers in town, and you know, I know Steve.
You could have cut him loose after a year. It's been 9 years.
Yeah,
that's pretty good, Steve. That's an endorsement of you, my friend.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Steve, then, before we get our only break, and we're going to hear Josh's story in our second half hour, and we'll talk to you more about what we do know about mental illness and reducing that stigma. You know, on a serious note here, you've spoken really openly about growing up, your struggles, your desire to get sober, the rough road that you've had. A lot of people with mental illness, not all, I don't want to overgeneralize, and I'm sure the professionals will correct me where I'm wrong, but sometimes they struggle with a lack of stability in relationships. Friends, family, people kind of come in and out of their life. Mm-hmm. They don't always have that consistency. And here you are, you got 9 years with a guy who views you as a friend. I don't know if you were sort of internalizing that the first year, the second year, the third year, or maybe you were. Were you thinking, this is someone who is there for me, and he's not going anywhere, and what that meant to you?
Yeah, that commitment and compassion. He was there, you know, and you know, once a week for 9 years. He's done. He's been there for me, and it's just a wonderful blessing for me to just. He's been there. I mean, he's proved beyond a shadow of a doubt his commitment and his compassion and his love. And yes, we are friends, mm-hmm. friends, and true blue friends. And we know each other like the back of our hand, you know, and the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so, yeah.
Well, and Dr. Killings, from your perspective, how much does that stability, you know, potentially buoy somebody who wants to go forward with their recovery? I mean, here's Steve. He got into this mentoring and then this friendship with Jim 9 years ago, and he's been sober for 4 years. So he didn't get sober and then say, well, now I'm ready. I mean, he was battling a lot.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, battling mental illness and substance abuse, it is a lifelong process. It's a lifelong struggle, sometimes battle. And Evan, you hit on the point very well in the fact that individuals dealing with mental illness suffer, I think, or have a difficult time maintaining consistency in their relationships because we as individuals tend to oftentimes hurt those the most who are the closest to us. So it's oftentimes where you'll get upset with your brother and your brother's done with you. You'll get upset with your sister and your sister's done with you. You have a job for a couple of weeks, you get fired from a job. You go get another job, you get fired from that one for whatever reason. So it is very important that there are consistent and reliable and dependable people in your life because you're dealing with, sometimes neurological disorders that impact your mood. One minute you're very, very happy and excited, and then the next 2 weeks you could be very down and depressed. And individuals who don't know how to handle that or deal with that will oftentimes say, I don't want to deal with it, and walk out on you. So having someone in your life who is consistent and reliable and dependable is very important for recovery as well as, you know, mm-hmm. maintaining a healthy outlook on life.
And one more question for Jim. Oh, no, yeah. I know you want to jump in. I know yeah. you also want to talk about how to help ourselves when we are struggling with mental illness. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I'm going to say the point just made about consistency is – oh, the point made about consistency is very, very helpful because – If you meet somebody, you know, once a week for 9 years, you're going to get to know the person, and you're going to depend. Steve depends on me visiting him, and I in turn enjoy his company tremendously because he has a lot to say. You know, I really it's a quid pro quo that works. Mm-hmm. And I was going to add that, friendship is something that. I value highly. I mean, I also mentor four other guys, okay? And it's just something in my blood now. I just love doing it. You know, I just like doing it. It's fun. You know, it's not about the money. It's not about the fame. It's about just doing it.
And as someone who has had, you know, your own recovery when it comes to mental health as well.
Right.
What would you say about helping ourselves when we need help?
Well, my sister taught me a lesson. She said, you know, if you're going to help yourself, help others. Try to help other people. You'll help yourself in turn.
Absolutely.
She taught me that a long time. Well, my sister's, she's the only sister I got by, there were seven of us or six now, but... Yeah, she's my sister.
Let me grab a phone call. Let me just grab one phone call before our only break of the hour. It's John in Webster. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call. I'm outing myself here. I've been a depressive all my life, and I never knew it. as a young man, I thought everybody was like me, but they just seemed to handle things better. I worked at it on my own when I realized that everybody wasn't like me. And I went through school. It was difficult. I had to work a lot harder than people who weren't depressive, but I came to America when I was 23 and went to graduate school here, and it took longer than it should have done, but I got my doctorate, and I taught. But there were times when the black dog, as Winston Churchill called it, would just overcome me. I lost 2 marriages because of my depression. I could never figure out that I was wrong and the way things were. I lost semesters in teaching because I just couldn't stand before a class. The first time I came here to Rochester was 26 years ago. And my sister and her family lived here, and I was teaching in Arizona, and I was just beyond everything. I was suicidal. I couldn't teach, and my brother-in-law came out and drove me back to Rochester, and I was here 3 years in treatment. And then I left and went back to the Mountain West and got back on my feet and went back to teaching. I had some severe issues with depression. I found a great psychiatrist finally in my life who stuck with me. And I always thought he was older than I until I just got a Christmas card from him saying that now he was 65, he's retiring, and I'm almost 80. And yet I, for some reason, thought he was older than I, maybe because of his wisdom. But here I'm in Rochester. I came here 5 years ago to live when the sister who helped me became mortally ill. And I came out to do anything I could. And my sons in California and the Mountain West said if I wanted to stay there, that's fine, Dad. I approached them on it. And here I am. I found some great groups of people who are philosophers, retired philosophers, as I am. And just about a month ago, we were talking about mental health, and I told them what had been going on in my life, and they were astounded.
John, can you hold there for 1 second?
Sure.
I just want to relate, because our friend Jim is listening without headphones, and Jim, and for our listeners who are just joining us, John on the line with us telling his story says he was depressed all his life, and he realized as he went throughout life, especially in his 20s, 30s, not everyone was dealing with what he was dealing with, but nonetheless occasionally overcome by it, lost personal relationships, lost work at times, through various means has tried to deal with that. And John, let me just say as well, as the host of this program, we have a number of semi-regular callers, and you're a semi-regular, aren't you? We hear from you once in a while.
Yes.
You're also one of the callers that makes this program so much smarter and better, because we have a host who's sort of mediocre, and we've got a very smart community of listeners. And every time John calls, I'm going, I don't know why I didn't think of that, or it's always so sharp, and John is generally pretty good-natured. Now, this is part of the problem with the stigma. Sometimes people would hear John on this program or myself, and I would say, wait, John can't be depressed. You know, he always seems so smart and upbeat and happy. And we have this idea that we should be able to look at somebody and figure out, oh, well, you're depressed, you're not. And it's not just about mood all the time. Sometimes it's out of our control. And I wonder, John, for you, you know, what it was like when you started to tell people, and you said they were kind of floored to hear what you had gone through in your life.
The first people I told was my mother, who was a war widow, and my sister and her family here. And they'd always wondered, you know, what was wrong with me, that I didn't get along in the family. I mean, I got along with the family, but I avoided them. I just couldn't sit and listen to conversations. But when they realized what was happening to me, they were very, very good to me, very good. And when I left here after 3 years in 93, we kept in touch every week by phone. And they became just a godsend to me. Not a religionist, but I'll use that word, because they kept in touch with me every week. As did my sons, once they realized that, wow, you know, Dad's kind of mixed up. So we ought to, you know, look at them differently.
Well, John, I'm really gratified that you shared your story here. Thank you for doing that. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, John. And and so what you're hearing John also say that really sticks with me, Dr. Killings, is when he finally opened up, yes, there were people in his life who said, well, there are times where you pushed us away and we didn't know what was going on, but we had no idea. And the reaction he had was warmth. It was, okay, if you're going to open us, then we're going to bring you in. And to me, that just strengthens the importance of saying, if we can get people to open up, that hopefully they will encounter that love.
Right. And sometimes it's difficult for individuals with mental health issues to open up because, again, the stigma, or they're not quite sure what's going on with them. You know, I'm happy today and tomorrow I'm sobbing, tearful, and crying. What is wrong with me? What is wrong with me? And I think oftentimes when we're going through, you know, an array of emotions and sometimes without a trigger, it's important to speak with your primary care physician. As a part of a crisis therapist with the Mobile Rochester Community Mobile Crisis Team. The number is 275-5151. Yeah. We're a mobile crisis team. We will come to your home and help individuals with mental illness get connected to mental health services. A lot of people don't realize that that service is out there because there are some individuals here who don't have a primary care doctor or are struggling with insurance concerns. We will come to your home and help you get connected. We'll help diagnose and help you get connected with mental health support within the community. And in instances such as those, when individuals don't know what it is that they're dealing with, we can help you kind of get linked with some supportive services here in the community.
I'm way late for our only break. Josh, can we talk about your story when we come back?
Sure.
All right. So we had just a lot of really inspiring stuff from our guests here. We're talking to a community from Compeer. And online, Compeer is where you learn more online. Oh, Dr. Killings, I'm challenging you. You better grab it, Dana. Dana Frank, Executive Director.
I toss that to Dana.
Online where, Dana?
CompeerRochester.org.
CompeerRochester.org. CompeerRochester.org. Let's get that only break of the hour and we'll come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections. In our second hour, it's the Summer of Food, the first in our series of 10 conversations about the local agriculture, dining, and food scene. We'll do everything from explore new restaurants in historic sites that have been years in the making, talk about trends as well, give you a sense of what local organizations are doing. It's the Summer of Food launching Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to bring in Josh Lowe to the conversation. And originally, I met Josh and I said, oh, you're a youth match. And
yes.
you kind of corrected me a little bit. What's the story here, Josh?
I was a youth match for about maybe 5 or 6 months. And then we eventually ended the match because the guy that I was matched with wasn't consistent. He was always late, so eventually we ended the match. And then I went over to Big Brothers Big Sisters and got a match there. We ended that match, so now I'm kind of stuck in between both.
All right, and this is where I bet a lot of listeners are hearing their stories and they're thinking, this is something I think I want to do. But you heard Dana say earlier, If you got to do it, you got to commit. And
yeah.
And 4 hours a month is not a lot. So it's definitely doable, but if you commit, you need to be there. Because, Josh, what was it like for you when people were late, when people weren't showing up?
I was mad because we were looking forward to meeting. And at sometimes the match with Compeer, he wouldn't even show up. So most times he'd be late, and the other times he wouldn't even show up.
Dana, is that hopefully relatively rare with your mentors?
Yeah. Yes, it's relatively rare, and I'm sorry every time because that consistency is so important. As Stacey was saying, a lot of these folks, it's a rejection, it feels like, I think, you know. So we do our very hardest to monitor a match and find out what's going on, and as he said, that at some point we just have to give up because it's doing more harm than good sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Josh, why don't you back us up a little bit and tell us, you know, why you were in touch with them in the first place, what's going on in your life, and how you're doing?
At the age of 2, I was diagnosed with ADHD, and I have been on different medicines to treat that. Right now, I'm on 3 different medicines to treat my ADHD and aggression. So far, I've been doing pretty well for like maybe the past 6 years, maybe. I moved to Rochester in 2012 and been here since August of 2012. August 8th will make 5 years I've been here. Mm-hmm. Currently, I am receiving therapy at Hillside on University. Back in 2013, I was transferred from Forest School to Crestwood. And I've been there, 2 years? And got discharged in the summer of 2015 and then went to North Star over on Hart Street. And now I'm at Leadership and I've been there for 2 years. But pretty much with the matches, my first match with Compere, he was pretty cool, but the fact that he was always late wasn't okay. We ended that match, and then about maybe a couple months later in June, with Big Brothers Big Sister, I got matched with the guy, and then he picks me up every day. But eventually, we had to end the match because he hadn't seen me in 2 months. Mm.
So what are you looking for from a match? What do you want to get out of that relationship?
Support, for them to just be able to listen.
Sometimes you just want to be able to talk, to let it out. And is it venting about your frustrations, about it's about other things around you?
Pretty much anything.
Mm-hmm. And is it hard right now to find people in life who will listen?
Unfortunately, yes.
Well, there's this stereotype that you and I gotta eliminate here, that men don't talk, you mm-hmm. know, that men don't open up, men don't have feelings, and you clearly do. And what do you feel the benefits are when you do get that chance to kind of let it out?
That it's gone away and I don't have to worry about it anymore.
Just talking.
Mm-hmm.
Just talking. Dr. Killings, you want to tell us some of your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. It is so important that we as a community rally around our young people, our young males especially. Talk is therapy. In my everyday profession as a school psychologist, I will have a line of young men with appointments, and they'll often say, yeah, you know, I don't talk very much, and before you know it, an hour has gone by, and all I've said is hello. And there's also stigma with that as well. They feel like counseling is something medicinal. Metaphorically speaking, it is. It's just a conversation. It gives people a platform to say and speak whatever comes to their mind and recognize that whatever they're thinking or feeling, that there are probably several other people out there who are thinking and feeling the same way. It gives an individual an opportunity to have their thoughts normalized. Like the caller John said, he thought everyone was dealing with what he was dealing with. It just gives you an opportunity to release, and it's important that we do that. It's our body's natural function to talk and release those stressors and to talk through them, because if you don't talk through whatever is ailing you, you won't be able to get to the end and find that solution. And we all need a friend. We all need someone to talk to.
Josh, when you hear Steve and Jim talk about their story, do you have hope? I mean, that 9 years, a great relationship, you see the impact.
Yes.
Yeah, I saw you smiling several times. Does that give you hope?
Yes, of course.
And so now, hopefully, we can land in a place where people like Josh have matches. But Dana, what does that take? Is there a difference for a youth match and an adult match? How does that work?
There's a slight difference, but the biggest difference is, you said it, so I'm going to feel free to say it, is getting male volunteers through the door. You sort of said it. But I just want to say it's a wonderful opportunity. You have a lot of impact on a person by volunteering. And I know I think sometimes men think, well, I don't know if I can make that commitment or whatever. But if you just go do the things you normally like to do, it comes naturally. Mm-hmm. You know, you just do start talking and listening to each other after a while. first three visits may be a little awkward, but after that, it's
and sometimes
so
it can be helpful. Sometimes it can be helpful with for males mm-hmm. who are fathers, who already mm-hmm. have children, you know, mm-hmm. of certain age. Just go and mm-hmm. pick up another child around the same age and do, like Dana said, do what you naturally do anyway.
So you got a chance to do that. Online, you can contact Compeer.
CompeerRochester.org. Or you can call us at 546-8280.
And I want to ask Dr. Killing is one more question that kind of has been on my mind, not just from a conversation on this show last year, but what some of the research shows us.
Okay.
Because we opened the hour by talking about what Representative Judy Chu was doing out of California. Her bill would increase mental health awareness among Asian Americans. And one of the things that Representative Chu has pointed to are studies that show Asian Americans in particular are far less likely to seek counseling. We talked to Shamiqua Holdsclaw, who was here through NAMI Rochester last year. She's the Michael Jordan of women basketball. I don't like to compare women athletes. Men, women stand on their own. But if you want to know who she was in women's basketball and you forgot, one of the greatest women's basketball players of all time. But she talked about how growing up, there was a view, particularly in her church, that suck it up, you know, that we don't show weakness. And she said in communities of color, it can be even harder. And so this is not my expertise, but when you read about this, when you hear Representative Chu talking about stigma, especially in communities of color, you go, well, what are we going to do about this? What do you think?
Well, I think we have to educate ourselves. I can speak as an expert, as a woman of color growing up in a home. What goes on in the home stays in the home. And if you're sad, suck it up, you know, brush your knees off, get back up and keep going. I think it's important that we educate ourselves. I think that, you know, as the younger generation and as things are happening with the aggression and the violence that is happening, you know, within our cities, I think we need to, it is important that we see what is happening and start looking at some of the solutions. And oftentimes the solution is that individuals who are suffering from mental illness, they need that support. And it's important that we put it out there that it doesn't have to be anything negative. It doesn't have to be something negative against the parents or the parenting. It is an illness and it can be treated, but if you don't acknowledge it, if no one acknowledges it, we're not going to be able to get the treatment and the help mm-hmm. that we so desperately need mm-hmm. in the community.
Yeah, I know. Jim, you want to weigh in? Go ahead.
Yeah, and I would say that Compeer is a great conduit to that, to giving assistance in the community for people who really need it. You know, I think it's volunteer, and it's a great way to meet people. I mean, different people, you know, we're all mm-hmm, human, mm-hmm. but we all have different attributes, you
Absolutely.
Know. It's a great way to meet people and make lasting friendships.
Absolutely.
The National Alliance on Mental Illness estimates that African Americans and Hispanic Americans used mental health services at about half the rate of white Americans last year, and Asian Americans used mental health services at one-third the rate of white Americans last year. We have to do something about stigma. Right. Let me get some final thoughts. I want to turn back to Steve Smuck, who's told his story this hour, and we just really appreciate you doing that, Steve. You know, maybe just some final thoughts from you on do you think if we would have talked 9 years ago, I know you were meeting Jim for the first time, maybe you had high hopes for that, but your life was in a different place. Would you have thought that you would be come this far in your life? I mean, would that have surprised you if I went back a decade ago and said, this is where you're going to be?
I didn't think at that time that I would ever get well. I didn't see the light at the end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. I knew I needed help. I didn't know the answers. I was seeking, and it's divine intervention. I didn't see the wellness and the mental and emotional wellness and the physical health and the spiritual health. I didn't see the light. And I just want to add this little factoid here, hardcore reality about suicide. It's a horrible, it's the worst place you can, for a human being, young or old, to be at where you don't see no light, there's no hope. It's a It's the final act. Robin Williams is a perfect example going through life, and just a perfect example. And yes, I had the mobile crisis team in my life on March, April, and May of 2012 when I was still drinking, drugging, suicide by cop. And it's a horrible place. I went and so, no, I didn't think there was any, it's a miracle. I'm a living, breathing, walking miracle. I should be in the grave or.
No, I mean, we're all going there eventually, but not for a while yet.
Yeah. Amen. Thank you, Jesus.
Amen.
Thank
Amen.
You, Lord.
Amen.
Steve, thank you. Thank you for sharing your story. Jim, thank you. I know that you see the impact. Josh, good luck to you.
Thank you.
I've got a feeling great things are coming for your future, and I really appreciate you sharing your story. Dr. Killings, learned so much from you. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
And Dana Fram, the executive director of Compeer Rochester, compeerrochester.org. Thank you for sharing the story.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we'll join you again right here Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.